Greetings, Raise Community. Brent coming in live today with a special guest and a special episode, number 200 of the Raise podcast. I am pleased to welcome Brian Hastings, who serves as president and CEO at the University of Nebraska Foundation. Welcome, Brian.
Hey, Brent. How are you?
I am great. I found a shirt that I thought would pass as red. It's a little more salmon than red, but more red than salmon. So hopefully this is okay.
Good effort.
Doing my best. Well, Brian, I'm excited to meet you because I feel like you're one of the leaders who, A, I respect a lot. B, I've been fortunate to spend a bunch of time with. But C, it feels like we're always talking about the present and the future. And so today I'm excited to talk a little bit about your past and your story and share that with our community and maybe even uncover some fun facts that your team isn't even aware of. So with that, I'm going to ask my go-to question. Why don't you take me back to junior year of high school? Who was that Brian? What was he into? What was your weight class in wrestling? And what led you to the Ohio State University?
That's funny. So, junior in high school, Cleveland, Ohio, St. Ignatius High School, Jesuit boy. I played baseball. I did wrestle a couple of years in high school. The joke I usually tell now today is my freshman year, I wrestled 112 pounds. So I kind of looked like Ichabod Crane. I was like 6 feet tall, 112 pounds, you know, just skin and bones. But I ended up at Ohio State. Honestly, Brent, I was a first generation college student. Didn't really go on college visits, just a couple. Applied to a number of institutions, some Jesuit institutions, some Ivy League institutions, some small Ivies. And I ended up going to Ohio State for mainly economical reasons. I had actually been admitted to Columbia off the wait list, and my college counselor was appalled when I sort of declined the waitlist acceptance on the spot. And my rationale was I could go to Ohio State for 4 years or whatever it would take for what 1 year at Columbia would cost me. And I was just pretty cost conscious as a first generation college student. And, and it turned out great. You know, I met my wife there, had both my children there, found my career there. It's funny how things happen in life as a result.
Brian, tell me more about the decision to cast the net that broad, especially as a first gen college student. I was in the same boat. And was that prompting from your parents, from your guidance counselor? I mean, I don't even know if I knew what Columbia University was, until maybe my junior, senior year of high school. So what inspired you to even think broader?
Yeah, I don't know that I could even pinpoint back to what the specific influence was. I'm sure the guidance counselor was part of it. You know, I did apply to institutions like Fordham, you know, a Jesuit school in the Bronx, coming from a Jesuit high school. Yale was my dream school. I didn't get admitted. I don't know why it was my dream school. I had a beach towel with a Yale bulldog on it, and I thought it was sweet. I wouldn't say it was really parental influence in any way. It was maybe a little bit guidance counselor, maybe a little bit teacher. You know, I studied Latin and Greek in high school, so I had some great classics teachers who, probably really recommended and helped me understand the importance of a liberal arts and sciences education for a foundation for anything that you do in life. But I don't even recall. Some of it was probably just me. So.
Yeah. And so normally I would wait to ask a question like this, but one of the, I think, really exciting impacts of philanthropy over the last decade in particular, but even yesterday, I believe MIT announced a new sort of essentially, no tuition agreement for any family that's under maybe something like $200,000 or $100,000 of household income. And, I'm curious, like, if you see those headlines, it's the intersection of your work, but also your experience where you might have made a different decision if cost wasn't a constraint. And I don't know, how do you feel when you see announcements like that across the higher ed landscape?
Yeah, well, I actually just read one last night from the University of Texas system that I think upped theirs for to 100,000 in under adjusted gross income. So yeah, there's more and more of that happening. We have the Nebraska Promise program here, which is a similar program at a lower income threshold. But I think generally, Brent, I'm supportive of any and all programs and initiatives that provide greater access and more affordable access to higher education. I mean, I think it's a core element of what we do to try to provide affordable access to an outstanding education. And if that happens through philanthropy, great. If that happens through state support, great. If that happens through institutions giving remissions, that's great. Although that can create some financial challenges for the institutions potentially too. So, but I'm generally supportive of broad and equitable access to higher education. I think that's what, drives our economy. It's what drives our workforces. I think it's what drives our future.
Tell me more about your college experience. What'd you spend your time doing? And my understanding is that was your gateway to advancement.
Yeah, so, I sort of stumbled into advancement like a lot of people of my age kind of did. I needed a job as a freshman. The girl I was dating at the time was going in to do an interview at the Ohio State Calling Program, calling alums and asking them for their annual gifts over the phone. And I needed a job. It was the highest paying student job on campus, and you didn't have to work Friday nights or Saturday nights. And so I was like, that fits with me, as a college student. So that was probably, yeah, really one of the, most important decisions I made. My girlfriend at the time decided it wasn't for her, and she left and wasn't going to pursue it. And I stayed, and I've never left the profession. That decision, right, really helped me find my career, and something that I, loved doing, was passionate about doing, got around people who were passionate about doing what we do. And that program is actually where I ended up meeting my wife. Years later, getting married and having our kids there. So, my college experience, it's interesting. I was a very involved, engaged high school student with clubs and activities. I probably took a little bit more non-traditional, casual path during my college years. I could tell you which bands were playing at which bars on which nights. I spent time working also at at the door, and eventually bartending at a campus bar as well. But
Oh, can I ask which bar? Is it still around? What was your favorite bar, your favorite
well,
band?
unfortunately, the Beer Stube, Bier Stube, Stube, actually just shuttered its doors this fall. One of my college roommates ended up buying it from the former owner. And a short version is the land got sold to build a high-rise complex there with, sort of mixed-use student housing and other things. And so hopefully we'll see a revival of the Beer Stube, because it was a real staple on the Ohio State campus. So,
I'm getting
but great times.
the Pave Paradise and Put Up a Parking Lot vibes from you right now.
We'll find a way to do it. So yeah,
The beer stoop will rise again. All right, fair
sure.
enough. So when you think about the time as a student caller, by the way, it's been one of the most commonly cited, right? It is the gateway to so many people that have gone on to sit in your seat to be leaders. And I have to ask, like, are there any specific moments, memories, conversations, highlights, lowlights that you recall from that time, or just more generally being inspired or intrigued by the work?
I don't know if I could pinpoint to any, one thing. There was a whole bunch of things. We had a great group of people that we worked with, right? And I think in any work environment, right, the team and the colleagues, makes it, right? And there's so many people that I work with today that are still in development and in advancement at Ohio State, and who have moved on and done things at other institutions. Myself moving here to Nebraska 12 years ago. It was a really good cultivation area for future fundraisers and future advancement officers. And so To me, when I look back on it, you know, probably the most fondest thing is just the relationships, the connections, the friends. Actually, one of them texted me yesterday, who's a former student caller, colleague of mine. And we had an exchange, you know, best man at my wedding was one of those callers that I met there. So, you know, as I said, my wife eventually worked in that program and I met her there. So, you know, there's a whole, whole host of things. Relationships.
It sounds more like you're describing a fraternity than a student calling team right now.
Well, there may have been a little bit of an element to that. Yeah. I wasn't in a fraternity, but maybe that's the closest thing I got to one.
I love it. I love it. You should get some Greek letters for the call center, maybe. But tell me, so how do you then land at University of Dayton? And allegedly, one of your colleagues shared that there may be some connection in some form or fashion to high school wrestling, but you tell me.
No, not really a connection to high school wrestling. So at Dayton, I ended up going to Dayton when I finished at Ohio State. Mainly was because, candidly, my mentor, Jerry May, who's now retired, longtime VP of development at Ohio State and then at University of Michigan. Jerry was kind enough to spend time with me when I was looking to pursue this as a professional career. He literally wrote letters of recommendation to people that I didn't know in this profession to try to get my foot in the door somewhere. Really helped me think about the type of place to look for where I could grow and get different exposure and different opportunities. And then University of Dayton ended up presenting that. There was a values fit there for me, right? I grew up and went to Catholic school my whole life. I went to a Jesuit high school. University of Dayton's a private Catholic Marianist institution, so a different order. So there was a little bit of a values fit there in terms of just the institution itself. But they were actually adopting the same software and calling system that Ohio State had been using, and they were having some issues and some challenges with it. So it put me in just a unique situation because I knew the system where I could come and help them get that program launched and up and running while doing other things. And so I started kind of overseeing phone-a-thon and direct mail, and then I picked up reunion class giving and worked with reunion class giving committees and chairs, and then ultimately, you know, became the director of annual giving there. University of Dayton is a great place. I still got a UD sweater in my closet and pull it out. I still root for the Flyers. Great basketball institution. And again, love my time there. You know, I'm proud to say that when I left the University of Dayton to go back to Ohio State, I cried at my going away party. And when I left Ohio State to come to Nebraska 12 years ago, I cried at my going away party. And to me, that just sort of speaks to the quality of the relationships and the people you work with and the care and the effort, right, that you put into the work. And, I was emotional of both of those departures, but I'm a pretty emotional person. I wear my heart on my sleeve most of the time. UD was a great place. And it did. I mean, because I was only there about 4.5 years. We doubled the number of alumni donors and alumni participation during that time. The university president was a longtime president, Brother Ray Fitz. I mean, he would take my top callers out to dinner once a semester. And the callers knew that we had sort of a competition around it every semester, and they'd get dressed up and we'd go get pictures with Brother Ray Fitz in his office and they'd go out to dinner. I mean, it was just to have somebody in a presidency care about what you were doing at probably the lowest level, right, at the development totem pole, and he supported that work. And Brother Ray Fitz said to me at one point, he said, "Brian," he says, I can't emphasize enough how important your job is. You are preparing these kids to go out and work in the workforce, and when they go out in the workforce as University of Dayton graduates, a lot of that is going to be influenced by what they learn from you and how they learn to work." And so he just had a really good way of inspiring you and helping you see and understand the importance of your work in the mission of the institution, not just raising the dollars, but coaching the students and a number of them. I mean, there's one of them who's an AVP for Health Sciences Development at Ohio State today.
Name names. Talk about the UD mafia. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, so lots of good ones. So,
I mean, that's so inspiring. And every time I hear stories like that, never don't have familiarity with President Fitz, but just sort of leadership 101. And then it just makes me immediately think, okay, what is my version of that? How could I do a better job of that right now? Because the fact that you're still thinking about it, you know, 20 plus years later is amazing.
Well, I spent an hour with somebody yesterday who's a local nonprofit leader here who reached out and asked if I had some time to provide some advice on stuff, Brent. And I said at the moment, Jerry may help me early in my career. And candidly, Jerry may help me at every important step along my journey, including the decision to come here. You know, I said to myself at that point in time that I had people who helped me. I will never turn away an invitation or a request to coach somebody, to mentor somebody, to give somebody advice and counsel, because I just think that's how you pay it forward. And so I've been fortunate to have, you know, really significant, consistent mentors in my career and in my life, but also, you know, sort of episodic ones who've kind of, you know, weaved in and weaved out at different stages of my career who provided critical counsel. But yeah, my belief in that is, right. People provide stuff to you and help you, and you got to give that back and try to give it back. So others can find their way too. So I love doing that. It's rewarding. It's energizing. Love seeing young, newer professionals find their path, find their calling, find their passion, and then watching them grow. It's an awesome thing.
I love it. And so tell me more about the transition to Ohio State. Maybe you felt like, it seems like you maintained the connection there. And so maybe it was only a matter of time, but you sort of grew up in this annual giving call center world at UD, and then transitioned into a frontline position. And just tell me about that change. It's a, completely different job, I think, from what I would imagine based on the title that you took.
Yeah, so it was, again, you know, I kept in touch. So another gentleman who was a mentor to me was Jerry May's deputy. His name was John Meyer. He's retired many years ago, too. But John was the associate VP at Ohio State and kind of ran the campaign and, you know, ran the staff. And John and I kept in touch. And so when the time was right, you know, personally for me and, you know, my girlfriend, fiance then at the time, you know, we're kind of getting ready for, you know, sort of, you know, to take the next step in our relationship and get married. John and I had kept in touch and just found the right opportunity to come back. So I went back actually as a fundraiser in the College of Arts and Sciences from which I graduated. I specialized in mathematical and physical sciences, working with those departments. Just kept my head down, tried to work hard. And fortunately, good things happened. I'd be the first to say I got lucky and was in the right place at the right time sometimes. And then, you know, it seemed like every 12, 18, 24 months, I wasn't pursuing something else, but I was being asked to take on something else or take on a new challenge or add something. And that period of time was just, you know, just again, tremendous growth in terms of the breadth of experiences that I got, the breadth of the team that I was overseeing and what they were doing. You know, at one point in time, I kind of, you know, thought, you know, sort of joked that I was kind of the AVP for the Island of Misfit Toys. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but it was just, I sort of had the odds and ends. I still had annual giving and I had kind of our special giving program and our stewardship and donor relations efforts. But then I started to pick up major gift programs for kind of university-wide initiatives, so scholarships, merit scholarships, need-based scholarships, critical difference for women scholarships, the libraries, those sorts of things. And then, you know, then that led into some colleges and some schools, colleges of social work and other things. And it just evolved from there. But yeah, that was really a, you know, I knew I wanted to kind of pursue that path. I mean, I can remember at some point in time being a student caller and thinking, gosh, someday I might want to kind of, you know, try to figure out how to run an organization like this or lead an organization like this and create, again, to me, it was more about creating more opportunities for kids like myself, a first generation college student, to have a chance to go to and become the first, right, in their family to graduate college and what that does for your family. And so there was always sort of a deep underpinning sort of mission. Yeah. Focus to it for me. It wasn't just, you know, wanting to be a leader. It was really about what the work that we got to do and what we get to make possible through this work.
And you and your team have done that more times than we'll ever be able to count. But we try to count through the lens of campaign totals and donor counts and so forth. I'm curious, during that time at Ohio State, or maybe UD, or maybe, you know, now, what are some of the moments that stand out where you really personally felt like you achieved that, where you can directly connect the dots between your work, your team's work, and specific students getting access in the way that you said drives you? Because I think that's where sometimes, and I guess part of it is, how do you keep your team connected to those individual stories? Because we talk all the time about how do we steward donors, right? How do we help create a personal connection? How do we showcase the student transformation that could be directly attributable to a specific donor's support or scholarship? But there's a version of, like, how do we do that for ourselves to stay motivated? How do we do that for our team? And I'm just curious, like, when you felt that impact of your work.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if I have a great answer for you, Brett. You know, it kind of comes and goes.
I'm sure you've been around plenty of scholarship dinners.
Sure, moments facilitating
that connection between donor and recipient or beneficiary. And I feel like so much of that work, we're always thinking about it through the lens of the donor and the stewardship and the student. But it's also, I would imagine, super energizing as a leader and as a teammate.
It is. And, I had a colleague walk in here yesterday to tell me about an event that we did here recently to honor some scholars in our College of Law. And one of the stories that she shared, that a student shared at this reception, was just with one donor family who's made a significant investment in law students at Nebraska College of Law. And the student shared the story about how he had accepted a job, was going to go off and work an hourly role for like $18 an hour, never knew and envisioned that law school could actually happen for him. But he heard about these scholarships and he submitted an application. And then when he got the call saying he'd been, you know, accepted into the College of Law and receiving one of these scholarships, just sort of talked about it. I mean, here I was ready to go take an $18 an hour hourly job. And I can't remember if it was in a manufacturing industry or something along those lines. And, you know, here now this gentleman's going to have a chance to pursue his dream to become a lawyer. And how and why? Because this amazing gift and investment that this family's making in law students, and it's a family that I know and I've worked with. And it just, the matriarch of the family, the patriarch passed away a few years ago, but the matriarch was at this event. And I'm so delighted that, you know, she gets to hear these stories about the difference that their investments are making in these students' lives. But I mean, every day, Brent, I tell our staff in orientation, right, we can get so busy with everything, but every day, if you can find a little time to pause and look around, to read stories about what's happening at the university, you know, to just poke around on the websites, you know, you will constantly find example after example of where our work and how our work makes a difference. And, the hard part is, I think as leaders, we have to constantly continue to find ways to make sure we make that accessible and easy for people to see, because, right, the fundraisers probably get a chance to see it a little bit more up close and personal each and every day. But, you know, how do we show that to our finance committee or finance team members and accountants and to our advancement services colleagues? But there's all kinds. I mean, yesterday I recorded a video that we're sending to one of our major donors in New Jersey, who's she and her late husband have made a significant investment in our College of Pharmacy. We literally have more than doubled the number of pharmacy scholarships from private support. In 2022, I think it was 57. And in 2024, 121 scholarships to pharmacy students coming from private support. Why? Because of the investment that this family made. And so we're kind of doing these messages for Millie. Millie is her name. And so she's going to get these periodic messages from their scholars over the next few weeks and just bring some of these personal stories to her in New Jersey. The first one actually is from a student from Puerto Rico, which is right where you're at the moment. And so, So just, you know, every day you could find things like that. We just have to remember to do it
No,
and be intentional about it.
you're so right. And so a couple things come to mind is one, how do you do that? Or maybe this is a challenge. Like, for example, I don't know, that student who was willing to speak at the law school event. Do you ever invite somebody like that to join an all staff meeting? Could
Yeah,
you?
we do. Yeah, we do. We every year, you know, because we're spread out across the state, you know, our foundation services the entire university system. So essentially we support four universities, five, if you know, would count and should count our College of Technical Agriculture out in Curtis. So so we bring our staff together in person once a year. Every August, we do quarterly all staff calls via Zoom or Teams or whatever it might be. But every time we do that together, the two most requested, valued, appreciated segments of that time together are usually hearing from donors about what they've done, why they've done it, and what their experiences have been, and then the stories around students and student impact, right? I mean, the impact on students is always the most powerful thing in everything that we do. You know, we do a lot of work with university leaders, and I love presidents and chancellors and deans, and right, you know, they're critical partners in the work that we do. But at the end of the day, if we could just figure out how to showcase and feature students to our alums and our donors, I mean, they'd be very happy.
Yeah, no, I love it. But it also makes me then wonder, why is the public narrative on higher ed so skewed in the other direction? When you see these stories every day, like you just said, every day, if you just look, the stories are right there. The life-changing transformations are right there. And I'm not saying that there's not valid reasons to critique or challenge you know, aspects of any industry or business, but it feels like the scales are out of balance relative to the amazing stories that you get exposure to all the time.
Yeah. Well, it's been one of the tougher things, I think, if I look back on my career journey, Brent, is right for much of the early phases of my career, right? Higher education was one of the most trusted, most valued sources of information and research, most respected institutions. And right, we're just in a different era today where, you know, not just government, but, you know, now today, even nonprofit, right? Trust in nonprofit sector, and particularly trust in higher education, you know, has been and is declining. And so, no, but I think we got to take a hard look in the mirror on that. And I think we got to own that. I know there's been some efforts through some of our professional associations and others to try to bring more of a coalition around these things and try to figure out, you know, how do we do this in a better way? But, you know, I mean, we have to figure out how to more succinctly articulate our value proposition and our impacts and our outcomes. And I think sometimes in the academy, we start to talk in a very academic way. You know, we use a lot of big words and we're long and winded with what we say. And I think we got to get a little bit more into this sort of soundbite culture and social media era that we're in. And we got to bring facts. But I think there's a whole bunch of contextual stuff too around this, Brent. So we, you know, our alumni populations are becoming increasingly younger as our older grads, you know, pass away. So we've got a younger audience during that period of time, you know, last 20, 30 years, right? We've seen this huge proliferation of nonprofit organizations. There's so many opportunities, right? I see it, my wife and I, and the community events and activities that we go to with our friends, you know, here in the community, right? We're engaging in those things. There's so many things creating opportunities for people to engage and to get involved. But what's happening, and we see this through some data that we do every year in our own alumni surveys, but, you know, another vendor company out there is actually partnered to do a national alumni survey across 20 or 25 institutions. That data reinforces this too. Recent graduates are engaged in their communities and they're giving in their communities. They're not engaging and giving with their alma maters, right? Something's off, right? And so, you know, I think we have to own that. We got to figure out how to have conversations with them and figure out why, right? Why that is and how they want to engage with us. And we got to create opportunities for that. But I think some of that backs up to the, you know, what's the student experience like? you know, some of this is sort of age old stuff, right? How are we graduating students who understand the need and the opportunity and the value of being engaged in supporting the institutions after they graduate? And then how do we engage them in effective ways, right? I've heard stories from, you know, you and others, right, about like, you know, their institution sending them direct mail and asking them to write a check. And like, you know, I don't even have a checkbook, you know, those sorts of things. And so, you know, through the work that you guys have done with Evertrue and others, right, you know, we're trying to innovate, I think, across the profession in that space. But I think there's, you know, giving days, right? We're all doing giving days, but so is every nonprofit.
Right.
Right. Right. I think people are going to get worn out on giving days.
Not only nonprofits, but individuals, right? When you think about a GoFundMe element where it's down to the individual. And I do think that's where people are being conditioned to really want to understand the direct impact of their gift, not a hypothetical or an illustrative impact, the specific impact. And if there is a, you know, somebody who, you know, has an accident and they need X dollars to pay rent, and that's their story on a GoFundMe, that resonates with people. And I think the challenge for institutions is you have to go broad and specific at the same time. I remember having debates with, you know, some of your peers from the annual giving days early on, where it was like, Brent, we want unrestricted funds. How can we do more unrestricted fundraising? And it's like, well, look, you may want the funds to be unrestricted, but the more generic and the less specific the appeal feels, the less effective it's going to be. And so if you want unrestricted funds, you still better have crystal clear messaging around what the impact of those unrestricted funds will be. Or my actual recommendation would be stop fighting that fight and get highly specific with very restricted funds so people understand the impact of their gift. Because guess what? That major donor for the law school student you described, or the pharmacy, Millie, supporting the pharmacy student, they know what their gift is going to. It is a scholarship to support scholarship students to go from 50 to 100 plus farm. That is, it works because it is so restricted. And so I'm just curious, like, you grew up sort of in that world, how your thoughts or philosophies have evolved and how you navigate that when you've got an institution with so many different impact areas.
Well, I'll just, maybe the easiest way to answer this, and my head of our stewardship and donor relations area, donor experience team, has heard me say this a number of times. I'm a huge proponent and fan of Penelope Burke's work in this space around stewardship. And right, to me, there's really three fundamental things there. One, timely, sincere acknowledgement for the gift that people make. Two, informing them and assuring them when and how their gift is used. And three, reporting back on impact and outcomes. And you're absolutely right. Unrestricted or discretionary funds are typically harder for institutions to report on, but we have to hold ourselves accountable to do that. Our team's focused on those funds, the top 100 funds where we get the most volume of activity, and really trying to hone in on those, you know, impact stories and outcome messages so that we can kind of tell those stories and report back to those donors. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's really both, right? There are people who are going to really want a specific outcome and a specific interest in what they want to support. But there's also a lot of people relative to stage of life and what they're doing that they are just making a loyalty gift, or, you know, what they feel is an appreciation gift, right? Because they're part of the cause, or they're part of the institution. It's the right thing to do. It's maybe what they did in their family, you know, and I caution around those, right? You know, those are good gifts too, right? And if somebody's willing to make a discretionary gift and are comfortable with that, then let's focus on how we acknowledge them, how we assure them their gifts used, and how we demonstrate impact and cultivate that, you know, where they're interested and where they're comfortable giving. You know, you don't have to take that person to a very restricted intentional purpose, but it's right. To me, this is right. This is the big challenges that we have in our profession, is we've talked a lot about it, right? How do you scale personalized outreach in a meaningful way? But, you know, to me, this is also about, you know, what is one-to-one communications, messaging, and marketing look like. So yes, the outreach from advancement officers and development officers to these people and getting to a meeting and all the things that we've learned and are working on, right, to try to do that better and more efficiently. But there's other stuff like, you know, understanding how people want to be communicated with, right? You know, young alums don't want to read an alumni magazine, but we're still sending an alumni magazine to people of all age demographics across our profession, right? Because the argument is, right, the people in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s still want the alumni magazine. That's true. But are we investing enough in social media, and are we advancing enough with, you know, where those people are at? Yeah. You know, we just did a text reminder RSVP for an event a couple of weeks ago. It's the first time we've actually done it. You know, we do the print invitation, we do the email follow-ups, and, you know, email response is intermittent at best. Text response, 50% response in 24 hours to an event RSVP. Now, that may have just been unique to the audience that we had. It was a more engaged audience who's closer to us. I think finding out how people want to be communicated with, asking them what they're interested in, looking at their behaviors and our systems in terms of what they attend, how they engage, what they give to, all of that should create really a custom profile, right, for people in terms of their interests. We have to figure out how to find, develop, and leverage then the technology and the resources that allow us to communicate with those people about what they want to hear about, how they want to hear it, you know, in a way that they want to hear it. And right now, so much of the technology within our profession is still sort of, and the approach and the operation is still one size fits all. Colleges send out one email communication to all of their constituents. The alumni magazine goes out to everybody. There's still this very mass communication sort of orientation across higher education that has to become more sophisticated, more customized. I
think both at a one-to-one and one-to-many level, there should be a real opportunity to unlock new levels of personalization. It's never going to be true, one-to-one, human-to-human at the size that you're operating. But I think what your team has proven through the work that you all have done, I think really at the forefront of the sort of donor experience space and just the work that has been done to scale more outreach, more personalized to more people. Clearly, you know, many folks around the industry have followed suit, and I expect that to continue. But what has yet to be realized in the way that I think is coming soon is, and I was fortunate to host a webinar with your colleague, Nick Lindy, earlier this year on this topic, where when you think about like the enterprise that is the University of Nebraska, when you think about all the ways that somebody might be able to give, right? And then you think about an individual donor and all the little breadcrumbs you have of who they are and what they care about, from the types of the events they've attended to the funds that they've supported in their transactional giving history to comments they've made in discussions with gift officers to content that exists about them on the internet.
Yeah.
And you think about that body of knowledge and all of the ways that one might engage philanthropically with a system like the University of Nebraska, that's pretty overwhelming. And the way that we get at it today is, trying to make the best of what we have with the data, do the personalized outreach, get to know somebody, start to piece together sort of the algorithm in our mind of ways they might be interested, and then try to figure out the 1,000 different ways that they might be able to connect at the university. And that, to me, feels like something that should be and will be solved by generative AI, or at least that we can take a material step forward, because, even thinking about all the endowed and restricted funds that you guys have and the purpose description of all of those funds, like there's so much data sitting there that almost in real time could be mapped against the contact report. Yeah. Say, boom, based on the discussion between Brian, here's idea 1, 2, 3, 4. Doesn't mean this is what it's going to be, but you didn't have to spend, you know, an hour after the meeting Googling the University of Nebraska website or asking your colleagues, hey, do we do anything in X, Y, or Z regard?
I think AI will be part of this solution. You know, obviously, you know, we'll have to navigate through you know, privacy issues and concerns and data issues and concerns, you know, as we go through this journey. But I certainly think that will be part of the solution. You know, I just read and just shared with our team, you know, a Gallup research study that, you know, one in 10 employees today in the workforce are using AI on a weekly basis. 7 out of 10 have never used it.
Amazing.
And so, you know, but again, right, you know, ChatGPT went live, what, 2023?
Almost 2 years ago to today, like really.
Okay, so it's 2 years ago, 2022. Okay, I think this, you know, we're going to see a little bit of a hockey stick, I think, in terms of utilization and figuring this out. But I certainly think that's part of it. But I even think just around, you know, how we communicate, you know, how we manage content, how we deliver messages that matter, right? I mean, we've done a lot of message testing the last 2 years in our alumni surveys, and fortunately, we're figuring out which messages and the refinement of those messages that really move people in a positive way in terms of their impressions of the institution and the work that the institutions are doing. And there's just so much opportunity, I think, in that one-to-one personalized communication and engagement space. And technology and AI and other things are going to have to really enable that, I think.
No, I completely agree. And what I'll also comment is that while my example that I was sharing was unique to helping accelerate, let's call it matchmaking, once you understand more and more about a donor, right? Every new contact report or every article or new job that they get should provide data that might further refine the recommendations of where they, you know, might want to engage. But then that should be possible at a holistic universal segmentation level. So that now if all of a sudden there is going to be a future state when somebody says, who do we know? Which segment of our population is most passionate about first gen access?
Yeah.
And there are going to be examples where people have flat out said that 13 years ago in a contact report or have attended events relating to first gen scholarship, but it's buried in database tables that we can now activate on either a one-to-one or I think one-to-many basis. So tell me about where you're at now. You mentioned Jerry May sort of as the career Sherpa, helped you, you know, get this opportunity at Nebraska. You've had a great run there. What are you most proud of? And also, what are you most excited about going forward?
Oh, I'm most proud, I think, in many ways, Brent, of our team. We've just had a great team here. I think we've got a great culture. I mean, we're really we describe it as a strengths-based, engagement-focused, performance-driven organization. And I think that really sums up our culture, right? We use Clifton Strengths with everybody and help them understand what their natural sort of hardwiring and natural talents and tendencies are and how to manage those, how to mitigate, you know, where some of the gaps and weaknesses are that we all have. And so, you know, we want people to be their best selves in life, but also in here at work and in the office or in the work that they're doing with our donors and alumni. You know, employee engagement matters to us. You know, we do Gallup Q12 every December. We have a great wellness program, the only company to win the governor's award, highest award twice in our state. You know, creating opportunities for people to really understand and engage with all aspects of wellness, whether that be physical, mental, financial, you know, spiritual, whatever it might be. So I'm really, really proud of our leadership team. I'm really, really proud of the culture that our entire team of associates have really built and cultivate, and kind of this strive to just continually be better at what we do. You know, I'm really proud of the work that we're able to make happen for the university. You know, Nebraska is a great state. It's a small state in terms of population. It's a broad state in terms of, you know, land. You know, we have tremendous philanthropic support here. You know, I sometimes sort of say that, you know, the type of philanthropic support that I think we have in Nebraska doesn't really exist in this form in a lot of other places. I mean, I think we're really blessed with people who care deeply about our university. You know, we don't have professional sports teams. So people rally around our university and its programs, not just athletics, but its programs. And it's what people are attached to. And so, you know, my wife and I have talked about it, right? There's a lot of great pride in the great Big Ten institutions and similar institutions. You know, my wife and I are Ohio State graduates. There's tremendous pride in Ohio State. You know, the school up north, has great pride. You know, Iowa has great pride. You know, you go across, just the landscape of the Big Ten now with USC and UCLA and Washington and Oregon as well. But what here I think is really different is there's this intense state pride that sort of undergirds everything in Nebraska. People are incredibly proud to be Nebraskans, and I'm really proud of what our philanthropic community and university leadership and our team's been able to sort of partner on a lot of public-private partnerships and making great things happen for the institution. And I'm proud of our profession because we're trying to steer, I think, in the face some of the real challenges that we have, you know, whether they be these issues around perceptions of higher education and try to figure out how to tackle them and how to address them, right? Some of that we brought on ourselves, right? The higher education price index, you know, has outpaced CPI, right? So some of this is right over the course of 20 years or so, we may have brought some of this criticism on ourselves. And now when you see a lot of institutions, right, you know, holding their tuition rates and holding their fees. And some have gone a decade without increasing their fees. And so, you know, we're trying to allow, I think, for some of that to sort of course correct. But it's always a balancing act to, you know, to continue to deliver value and quality at the same time. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that I could say I'm proud about. But, you know, each and every day I get to wake up and work with just a great group of people who care about this university, who care about what it means to the future of our state. They just stay laser focused on trying to do what we do. I mean, we got a great team.
Tell me more about, you've built deep industry relationships. You mentioned your mentor, mentee relationship with Jerry May, but who are some of the people that if you're having a challenge or an issue, who are some of the peers that you lean on for perspective? It's one of the really unique things about this industry is just how willing your,
Sure.
parts are to help and share.
Yeah. Well, I've been, you know, I've, you know, well, a couple of things. One, input is one of my top five strengths. So, just generally in my profession, you know, I'm somebody who's kind of always looked at what others are doing and how they're doing it. What's the new next best thing? You know, what are some new initiatives? How are people trying to disrupt and innovate? And so, you know, so my natural hardwiring there around having input as a strength, I think has served me well because I always try to like to see and understand what's going on out there. But, you know, that's the great thing about our profession. You know, people sort of joke, right? Our professional association is CAES, Council for Advancement and Support of Education. Members have joked it's copy and steal everything from each other. At the board meeting last week, I'm on the CAES board now. We sort of joked about it's, you know, copy and share everything. Maybe not steal, a little bit more positive connotation around that. But I think we're blessed to be in a profession where people are willing to share and open up. I mean, I could name countless people. Lynette Marshall at Iowa, I consider to be a mentor. You know, she's been there for 16, 17 years, you know, at Illinois before that. She's awesome. Mike Kneder at the University of Wisconsin Foundation has been a great colleague and peer. You know, last week I had conversations with Matthew Lambert at William from William and Mary and Scott Morey, who was at Carnegie Mellon. Now he's back at George Washington. Across the profession, there's not been a, you know, I mean, earlier in my career, there are people like Carrie Pelzel, who was the VP at Dartmouth, Sarah Pearson, who was the VP at Northwestern. I mean, those people provided counsel to me and inspiration to me at different times. I mean, there's just I always, you know, I sort of, when I talk about professional development with our team, I always, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, okay, one, where's your network? Where's your network and your support network of people? You know, sometimes you get that from your supervisor, sometimes you get that from colleagues, but I also want people to be thinking about their network more broadly across the profession. And then what are you really focused on in terms of competency development or skill development or experience in learning and growth and those types of things? And so to me, that professional development is part influenced by your network and the people, but it's also, I think, influenced a little bit about the intentionality around what you're trying to do and grow and develop. And then there's another aspect of that too, like where do people want to go and where they're trying to get to long-term. But I actually talked with my board leadership this past year. You know, I'm 12 years in here now. We got 3 years left in this campaign. I don't feel like I'm getting stale, but I'm always constantly trying to think about, right, how to refresh and recharge. And so I'm probably going to find a way to take a little bit of focus time to maybe go immerse myself at some other places and with some other people. And so I'm doing a little bit of thinking around that now, about what that looks like, when I might do that, what I want to get out of it. But, you know, I'm going to probably go look for who do I think are the innovators and disruptors that are pushing sort of pushing the envelope in terms of the frontier of where our profession can go, and probably go spend a little bit of time with those folks and just, right, because this is how I learn. And it's energizing to me, you know, going back to kind of having, like I said, you know, input is one of my top five strengths. And I don't have a shortage of inspirations and partners. I mean, I've said this before. I mean, early on as an advancement professional, I got sent to go to a case conference in California somewhere. I can't remember where it was, maybe Sacramento or something like that. And, I met people at that conference who today are still lifelong friends and respected peers in this profession that I know I can pick up my phone right now and call. And if somebody doesn't answer, they'll call me back pretty quickly. I think it's one of the best things about our profession is the network that we have with each other.
It really is well said. And I hope that everybody listening, you know, thinks about that and takes a step toward reaching out to somebody that they've connected with at a conference or reconnecting or being intentional about meeting someone new, because in general, the door is open. People are willing to share. Brian, thank you for spending time sharing. The last question, one of your teammates wanted to really just ensure that we had on the record where the bow tie obsession started. Definitely a part of the signature brand. And for those that are watching on YouTube, you're seeing it. If you're not, now you're imagining Brian bow tie.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, I used to wear a bow tie once in a while and had a bunch of, you know, regular long neckties. And I don't remember how many years ago it was. You know, it's probably 10 years or so ago. I just sort of switched full over to bow ties. Now, my son's a pretty smart kid. Said, "Dad, that wasn't really a smart financial decision because you had to buy all new ties." And I said, "You know what, Joe, you're absolutely right." But I think there's been, I don't know what it was, Brent, but, you know, I'm sure there's some subconscious influence from three people who I've worked with in my career. One was Gordon Gee, longtime president, two-time president of Ohio State. He's finishing up his second term as president at West Virginia, right? One of the longest tenured presidents in higher education. Gordon's a bow tie guy. I'm sure there's some influence there. The late Andy Sorensen, who I only worked with for about 6 or 8 months, at Ohio State, but I respect greatly, was another bow tie guy. And then Jeff Hilperts, who's a former staff member and colleague of mine, who's now with BWF, was also a bow tie guy. So I'm sure there's probably some subconscious, subliminal sort of influence there from that. But to me, it was just, I don't know why, but some years ago, a decade or so ago, I just sort of made the switch. That's kind of my daily routine now. Well, I don't get stuck. I don't spill anything on my ties anymore too. So that's a good thing.
Well, here's my expectation. In 15 years, I'll be hosting somebody on episode 2000 of the Race podcast, and they'll be wearing a bow tie and they'll say that they were inspired by Brian Hastings.
I don't know. I don't know about that, but hopefully, you know, you'll be talking to a lot of people that I've had the privilege to work with and learn from, because you know, it's a great profession that we're in, and a lot of great people out there. So, and appreciate, Brent, what you and your team have done, and you know, you've been great partners for us and a number of other institutions, and you know, trying to push the envelope for, you know, what we do and how we do it. So, you know, keep innovating.
Thanks, Brian. We're going to keep pushing. And, you know, the reason is because of stories like what you just shared today. I mean, you've touched on the importance of stewardship, the importance of personalization, the impact on students, and it's inspiring to you. And it's why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I wanted more kids to get access the same way that you do. And, you know, we're not as directly involved by way of working inside a foundation, but we want to stay as close to that impact and that mission as possible. And it gets me fired up. So thank you for sharing today. Thank you to your team for all the collaboration and partnership. And we're super excited about the potential to keep on pushing and making a difference. And so with that, I would just encourage everybody, you know, follow Brian on LinkedIn. I think among leaders, he does a really good job giving you a window into his role, his leadership, his the events and the things that are top of mind. And I think more leaders would benefit from that. I think it helps not only maintain your network, but I think it's motivating to your team. And even as an external partner, I always like knowing kind of what's going on in your world. So with that, just want to say thanks, Brian. You know, reach out to Brian on LinkedIn, let him know that you heard him on the Raise podcast. And, you know, with that, I think we'll conclude today's episode. Great. Brian Hastings is the CEO and president at the University of Nebraska Foundation. Thanks, Brian. Great. Take care.
Thanks, Brent. Take care. Happy Thanksgiving.